Interspaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast.
Welcome to Interspaces, the research podcast of Bielefeld University's Center for Interdisciplinary Research. My name is Rebecca Moltmann and I'm looking forward to today's episode.
In the last few years, the rise of right-wing populist and right-wing extremist parties, politicians, movements, and groups has become a common phenomenon, contributing to the spread of far-right discourse and attitudes. And it's getting worse, as we currently see in Germany, Austria, the US, etc. A research group at ZIF has worked on this topic for 2 years under the title Normalizing the Far Right. Today, we want to talk about the different developments, the danger of normalization of right-wing positions, and about the effects on democracy. Paula Diehl and Birgit Sauer, the conveners of the research group, are here with me today. Thank you very much for being here. And could you introduce yourselves, who you are, what your areas of expertise is, etc.?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm professor for political theory, history of ideas and political culture at the University of Kiel. And I'm also the director of the International Populism Research Network.
Yeah, I'm Birgit Sauer. I'm professor emerita at the University of Vienna in political science, and I'm working mainly on gender issues, and I'm doing research on the far right with respect to their gender ideology and gendered mobilization.
And how did you get invested in this topic? I mean, it's obviously a really important, exciting research topic, but how did you personally get invested in that? And was there kind of a trigger point to apply for this kind of research group?
So, well, I'm originally from Germany, and I moved for the professorship to Austria in 1998. And I wasn't that familiar with the political situation in Austria. But then in 1999, the right-wing Freedom Party of Austria won that many votes in the elections for the first time that they were integrated into a government coalition at that time. And so everybody was shocked, including me. And so I got interested in the history of this right-wing Austrian party. And as a political scientist and as a gender researcher, I found that the performance of the then leader of the FPÖ, Jörg Haider, was so manly that I thought there is something gendered in this right-wing mobilization. So I started doing research in international research projects on the issue of the growth of the far right and their gendered mobilization. So, and doing this research, Paula Diehl and me, we met in a group that tried to establish a research group on the topic. This didn't work, but then the two of us said, well, we have to work on this topic. We have to work on the far right further. And I think what is interesting, so 4.5 years ago, when we started to write the proposal for the research group, we were thinking, well, in the not so far future, there is the danger of normalization of the far right. So that's how we got interested in saying, well, we have to do research on the mechanisms, the strategies of normalization.
Yeah, for me, it was also an old issue. I did my PhD on National Socialism, and then I moved to the representation of democracy. And in doing so, I necessarily need to look at the populism issues. And in the 2000s, there was a kind of raising populist movements and parties all around the world. It was a new wave of populist movements. At that time, I was working in a project with colleagues from France and Italy, which was called Populism Between Fascism and Democracy. So basically, we were not stating that populism necessarily is a step to have fascism, but we were trying to figure out how populism mixed with fascism in democracy. And we found out that there is a lot of elements which are combined, especially in the first phase of fascism, but do not necessarily belong to populism. So you can have very different kinds of populism. After this research on populism, I start observing the second development of this populist wave, which was pretty much a far-right populist movement. At the beginning, it starts just as a right-wing populist movements or groups, but just becoming more and more radical. That was the idea was here to have a research on the normalization of these movements. And the first project I had on this regard was together with a colleague of Bremen here at the CIF as well. It was a small conference and Birgit joined us for this conference. And then we start with the discussion to putting a more robust research on the topic. I think we were really interested in finding out how does it occur, but also which mechanism we can find to counter far-right and right-wing populist movements. And we are seeing a lot of demonstrations in different countries against this kind of normalization of the far-right through, I think, populism is a quite issue, important issue to make the bridge between far-right and democracy, just enabling the normalization of a far right. But that's also something that we are examining in the project.
Apart from your disciplines, which other disciplines are represented in your group, and how did you decide who to include or which disciplines you wanted to have there?
We started thinking about mechanisms which are not only in political discourse or political decisions or law. If you take the idea of normalization of a far right, as Ruth Wodak, who is also a member of the project, had very nicely shown in her work, you can see that that's not only a question of politics. It's also a question of culture. It's a question of dealing with history, producing pop culture, having education. It also permeates many different fields of society. And that's the reason why we thought it should be an interdisciplinary project involving all the scholars dealing with this mechanism in the different disciplines. But I don't know, maybe Birgit, you want to add something on that?
Yeah, no, but just a little follow up. So, well, we included linguists because language discourse is very much important as a mechanism for normalization. So expanding the range of what is sayable, which words are used. And then we can see how the vocabulary, the public vocabulary is changing and is just acquiring these right-wing narratives and words. So that's why linguistics is important. But also the media are very much important. So it's mainstream media that take over the language of the far right. But more important is so-called social media, which is terrain where much of the right-wing narratives is spread across the world, where we can see that all these conspiration narratives are spread over the internet. So that's why we thought media is very much important. Then, of course, sociology, because sociologists are occupied with the issue, how does this right-wing discourse get into the brains, into the hearts of people? So we also had a colleague who is doing surveys, but we also had law scholars, because it's also interesting, and we see it now, especially for the US It's important which role does jurisdiction play, and is it a so-called firewall against the normalization of the far right, or does the far right, as it is the case, for instance, in Germany, try to occupy positions in the judiciary to, introduce their ideology into this. So, but what is important is really that it's interdisciplinary, also the history perspective, which is also brought in by Paula, because she has a lot of skills in history. She did the work on National Socialism. And so we can see what are continuities in this far-right developments, but what is also different, what differs from history.
Yeah, the interesting thing, I guess, is there are some issues which permeate all the fields. And I guess gender is one major issue and migration is the second one. So dealing with gender issues and women are an object of that kind of politics. And also the way the refugee status is treated at the moment. And also, as you see in France, the kind of decision that had been made by Macron's government, deciding against the constitution that not all people living and paying taxes in France will have the same equal rights concerning social rights. These are developments that are to be conceived in a very, very broad sense and are deeply affecting society and politics as such. We also had scholars in the project like Luciana Villas-Boas examining the performance of the far right or far right mobilization, as we can see in the 6th January in the US, but also 8th January in Brasilia, when the supporters of Bolsonaro invade the seat of the government and the parliament. So you have here a kind of playbook being shared by social media, being shared by the networks, and being shared in the public media, also offline. And you see how actors are learning from each other. And we all are involved in perceiving these spectacles as a kind of part of our reality.
I think this is interesting to say, well, the group at the CIF was interdisciplinary, but it was also an international group. So we also focus on comparison between different countries, and we can see that there are similar strategies, that there is a sort of blueprint how far-right actors, parties, and organizations normalize their ideologies and their narratives. But on the other hand, we also see differences. We see differences in the performance, but we also see differences in the strategies to bring their ideology into the public space and to push forward their normalization. And I think this was also important just to see there are the similarities, but there are differences, and to understand what's going on in different countries. It's important to keep that in mind, that there are contextual differences and contextual situations and windows of opportunities where the far right is able to normalize their scripts and their narratives.
Speaking of differences, I think one major difference is the institutional set. We at the beginning, we had the discussion of a process going on in Poland and in Turkey. And there are very strong differences in the institutional set, which changed the way actors deal with law and law institutions. So some things were more difficult to implement in Poland than in Turkey and then in Hungary. So you have these institutional differences that are quite clear observable after the assault of the Capitol and the Planalto. So if you look at the institutional setting in Brazil, which was a kind of surprise for scholars from Europe, you will see a very robust democratic institution working. After the assaults in the 8th January, Bolsonaro was condemned, and he's now not allowed to take part in elections. And the contrary is the case for the United States.
So we dived already quite deep into certain examples and learned a lot about the group, but we have to dial it back, I think, for a second, and maybe come back to normalization as a concept in itself, because not everybody will know what that means. And I mean, the title of your group, like Normalizing the Far Right, kind of irritated a bit at first. I think that title is great because it does just that. So could you explain the concept of normalization for listeners?
Yeah, so we had a lot of discussion about this concept of normalization. But the first very simple idea is that far-right narratives and ideologies for a long time, especially in Europe after National Socialism, were not normal. So they were banned from public discourse, and the democratic discourse was based on values such as human rights, as equality, and so on. And so the right wing pushed towards inequality, towards exclusion, and more or less unethical thoughts, narratives, and behavior, they were excluded from the democratic public sphere. But what we can see over the last 20 years is that the public sphere changed, and that the right-wing discourse more and more moved into this democratic space. So we were interested in that, and we labeled this as getting more normal. The right-wing discourse is getting normal, is getting normalized. So, and then there is, of course, the strategy, a discursive strategy of just always repeating the words, the concepts, until they are taken up by the media and by the broader society. So we thought this is, of course, one mechanism of normalization, expanding the space of what is sayable. But then we also saw that, yeah, gender is a common topic in far-right organization and parties. And then we saw this is not only a discourse, it's also a performance. And we see that this also contributes to the normalization of far-right narratives, mainly the issue that there are natural differences within societies, because there is a natural difference between men and women. So we were interested in the project, in these mechanisms and discourses that contribute to the fact that the far-right ideology is taken up by different actors in societies. And it's not only contained in far-right organizations, but it's spread across the society.
If I may add something, we also discuss a lot what does it make with society. And to put in a very short terms, you can see that before normalization takes place, ideas of the far right concerning the legitimation of key principles of democracy, like freedom, equality, and human rights, could not come into the public sphere as a legitimate one. And the interesting here is that you have a kind of process which was triggered by the uses of populism. So at the beginning, the far right or far right actors combine very much ideas from the far right, like not all human beings are equal, not all persons need a protection by the human rights. And this idea were combined with democratic positions within the public sphere. One quite clear example of that is the question of ethnopluralism. A far-right position is to say there are different races and there are different hierarchies between the races. But the right-wing populist position coming in says, no, there's nothing to do with race. That's a problem of culture, and every culture deserves to be accepted. And we are for that. So we are claiming here that all cultures must be accepted in the places where they are coming from. So in the end, this means that you could never have a society welcoming different people from other places. But the positioning of this discourse is already within the democratic discourse, even though if it's perverting the very basic principles of democracy. And we realize that the normalization process is not only to getting used to this kind of discourse, but entails also reproducing it without or with knowledge of this reproduction. Sometimes you just reproduce without thinking about it. And in the second step, accepting the new norms of the far right as they were democratic. And I think the second step is something that we are now observing in many, many political decisions.
And why would you say is the normalization getting stronger? So maybe the try to normalize things more, because I mean, I can't imagine, like, people probably always try to normalize not as sayable things, but you mentioned, for example, social media. So is that maybe a factor how you can, like, normalize things like that more, stronger, whatever?
I'm not so sure if I understood your question.
Why is there an acceleration of normalization?
Oh, okay. Should I go ahead or would you like to? Okay. I think we should think about public opinion and public discourse as a kind of environment. This environment is never predetermined by one or two actors, or it's something like we are reacting to each other, and we are doing that in very different levels of interaction. And that's the reason why we wanted to have the interdisciplinary perspective, because you have it in society, we have in family, we have it in arts, we have it in pop culture, in politics, and so on. Social institutions, not only families, but also schools and other places where you are interacting with other people. Social media is one of them. And the question here is if one idea which were considered to be anti-democratic comes into the public sphere claiming to be a democratic, legitimate claim, and you start to accepting that, you all of us start of reproducing it. And all of us start in a certain way contributing to establish it as a norm. And that's the reason why you need a whole approach in order to treat that as an environment. So it means once it starts to go in this direction, you really need actors saying stop. In micro institutions like an interaction with friends, but also in big institutions like political parties. And you have this kind of forces. The demonstration in Germany against the far right in the beginning of last year and in the beginning of this year are very strong proofs that there are forces within society trying to say stop. The question is, how are the privileged actors like politicians reacting to it?
So I would say there is an acceleration of this normalization process through social media, because we can see that social media spread their narratives, even conspiracy narratives, so that we could see, well, the spread of fake news makes people unsure what they can know and what they can believe and what they can trust in. So I would say that the social media have a huge part in accelerating the processes of normalization. But what we can also see, and I think Austria is really a great field to look how the far right made it into the mainstream and got normalized. The Freedom Party was founded right after World War II, but it always has been a very marginal party, also sidelined by mainstream parties in the country. And then at the end of the 1990s, so with the start of the debate on globalization, Jörg Haider reinvented the party as a populist party, and he found one topic, and this was migration. And with these populist mobilization against immigrants, the party suddenly exploded and won nearly to 20% of the votes, while before they had 5% and not more. So this topic and creating, mobilizing fear against immigrants then really exploded the party. And this is, of course, also related to social and economic transformations in these years. So with this metaphor of globalization, the conditions, the living, the working conditions in European countries, but also in the US, changed dramatically. And then the mobilization of the far right, created a lot of insecurity in the people. And we see the acceleration. I think the COVID pandemic was also a crucial point showing that people do not believe into governments anymore. And the right-wing parties like Trump, they jumped on this insecurity, which was fostered by the pandemic, and said, well, all these established political actors, they are unable to deal with the pandemic, and they want to steal us our freedom. And then after the pandemic, with the Russian war against Ukraine and the inflation, we can see that the living condition of people worsened. And this was also something that right-wingers mobilized. And I think these are explanations why the normalization speeded up and why people got frustrated with the governing parties and then believed that the far right will save them.
I think the case of Austria is a so perfect case to start normalization. I mean, and Birgit, you have show that in many, many articles. So we have indeed a perfect case. The problem is that things continue to happen. And now we are going to a second phase, which is not normalization anymore, but radicalization. And that, I think that should be the further question to be studied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Paula, you also study the issue of fascization, so and microfascism, and so on. And I think, yeah, I think you're right. So normalization has happened. We can see this in Austria with the Christian Conservative Party going into government coalition with the extremist FPÖ. We can see that in Germany when the Merz from the Christian Party suddenly thinks he can bring through bills or parliamentary movements with the votes of the Alternative for Germany. So normalization has happened, and I really think we have to look forward and see how can we grasp what is going on. This radicalization The issue of migration, which boosts all these far-right topics and narratives. But I think this would be really the next step to see what happens now after normalization.
And you said the radicalization is the next phase, the second phase, I think you said. And regarding the situation in Germany, you already talked about the demonstrations that are going on and the different bills or movements that central parties try to start, so to speak. How could that happen? And like regarding the whole situation with the Brandmauer, the firewall in Germany at this moment, why could it come this far? And I mean, of course, we can't foresee the future, but what's to expect from the next months and years?
I guess scholars in the field, not only in our project, are all in the same page. We have observed a kind of a mimicry from the conservative parties, not only in Germany, but in Germany especially, with the focus of a strategy of trying to copy in order to get the votes from the right-wing populist parties. We know that it doesn't work for longer than one period of election. So you will have the win in the first election, but after that, the conservative party will lose. That's what we have observed in the Netherlands, in Austria, which is now building a government with a far-right, right-wing parties, a kind of radicalization here too, as a major party at the head of a government. We all know that that will be what is probably happens if conservative parties start copying those who are the far-right or right-wing populist parties in order to get the votes. So the question here is, what are they doing that? We don't understand why they are doing that. I think the political cycle is now very short. So they are thinking just in terms of the next elections, but not in terms of how a democratic party should survive. And that has two different implications. The first one is, of course, on the party landscape. So which are the parties which are still representing the spectrum of democratic possibilities to have a government, and we are seeing the spectrum shrinking. And the second one is a normative problem. Are we still democratic if we are putting into question, at least at the moment, two of the principles of democracy, like equality and human rights? And there are some attempts to also put in question the principle of freedom of speech. I think that's something that we need to think about, and researchers on the field are warning the parties, not only the conservatives, but the conservatives are more affected by this process all time.
Yeah, and I would say, well, I think some of the European parties are fascinated by what is going on in the US and say, well, we need more of this, for instance, in Germany. And on the other hand, I would say some of them are also, even from the conservative parties, are shocked what is going on, because they see that Trump is destroying not only democracy, but he aims to destroy the state. And then there will be a sort of what's already going on. There is a sort of state capture by big capital. And then there will be no state. And I think this is something that shocks even conservative politicians, who are thinking, well, they might go into a coalition with the far right. But it also shocks capital in European countries. So again, for Austria, For instance, the Raiffeisen Bank, which is a conservative bank in the country, but also the Association of the Industrials, they pressed the conservative not to go into a government coalition with the Social Democrats because they feared that the Social Democrats will push through higher taxes for them and that they will have problems to get profit and so on. But now they see what is happening in the US and they somehow are afraid because this, if there would be such a destructive force and if Musk would also intervene into Austria, they would be afraid that if the state is destroyed, they can't work, they can't make profit anymore in European countries. So I would say there is also still hope for Europe that the US is not the blueprint for European parties and European societies. But I think they have a lot of pressure that the conservative parties, I would say their strategy is to use the right wingers to press on social democratic parties and to green parties to not to push forward more social policies or not to push forward environmental policies. So I think this is how they somehow play with the right wingers. So I'm personally not sure if we will get Volkskanzler Kickl, how he labels himself in this Nazi wording. Maybe there is still the window that there might be another government. Well, but yeah, we can't see into the future. But what we can see is that there is a huge crisis of political authority, not only economic, but also of political authority.
And here again, if I may add something, there are very important differences from country to country. If you look at Italy, for example, you have a very strong state. If you look at Argentina with Milei, we have a kind of a libertarian, a far-right politician trying to destroy the state. So you have very different patterns in dealing with institution and with politics related to the state institution as well.
I think it's nice that you talked about hope, because I think that's always a thought your mind jumps to when you're talking about these things. Because I mean, it looks quite shocking often if you talk with friends or with other people about if it gets worse in Germany, where would you even go if you would leave the country? Where would you move? Because there are so many different countries and the situation in them is all quite bleak. So I think it's always nice to have like a little beam of hope. But are there countries that, I mean, they obviously also see what's happening in the world that react to that in a better way and they that have like a positive example? Is there a good example for that?
I think Brazil, despite of all precarity, because the society is really polarized, and you have a lot of supporters of the Bolsonaro movement, and you have also a grassroots of the far right as well. But it looks to me that you have a very strong institutional defense of democracy, and it is working at the moment. We don't know how it will develop with the pressure. And again, society is divided. Lula won with really a margin of 2%. It's almost nothing. It can be reversed. But it proves once again that institutions are important. You have other places like Poland, when you have a coalition within civil society and many different political movements and parties against a far-right politics. And you see there was a change in the government. So there are always specific possibilities for democratic hope and for democratic organization. But the question is, first, which is the scope? Can you use the whole scope? Can you use everything that you have to defend democracy and how are political actors reacting to it? I think the second one is a huge responsibility of politicians to act to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would also add that the case of Spain is interesting. So where you have a social democratic government, but also a growing right-wing party, and so Vox. But nevertheless, you can also see a lot of mobilization, even within irredentistic region such as Catalonia. And you can see a lot of mobilization for democratic self-determination. And so the mobilization in Catalonia was mainly against the then Partido Popular governing in Madrid. But you see, there is a lot of mobilization against the right. And so this year, the year of the 50th year of Franco's death, they now start to work on their history, which they didn't do for 50 years. They just ignored the Frankist terror regime. And now they start to do it. And there is a lot of mobilization, civil society mobilization. Of course, there is also a lot of critique by Vox and by the conservative Partido Popular. But I think there is hope, and I think civil society is not only the movements, the organized movements. We also have to think, as Paula already said, how can we start opposition to the far right in very small private, so-called private communities, because people consume social media in their private spaces. So I think we have to start there. We have to start the democratic project in very small communities. And what happened in Munich now, the demonstrations, I think that's overwhelming. How many people are there? How many people get mobilized now for a long time? So I think there is still hope. And if we would lose hope that the far right can be defeated and that the center parties might move towards a more socially equal society. If we would lose this hope, nothing would happen. So,
may I add something? I mean, as a social scientist, we are also observing mechanisms in society and in politics as well. And I thought what happened last year in England was quite interesting. You had a riot of far-right extremists, which was very violent against migrants and refugees. And you had a double reaction to it. The first reaction was an institutional. The Labour Party really used the mechanism you have to protect the state and state order very, very effectively. And the second one was on the civil society, on the level of the civil society. You had the grandmothers against the far right, building a protection in front of a building of the refugees in order to make a barrier against the far right extremists. And they were very successful. So you see here that maybe it's not so difficult to do it. And you see an extremely tension situation when grandmothers are standing in front of a building. And on the other side, you have far-right extremists ready to employ violence, and they didn't. There are a lot of mechanisms within civil society to be studied here, where you can see that democracy is also a form of society, not only a form of politics.
I think that's a very important point. And is there anything, coming back to the second phase of radicalization, what tools do you have to de-radicalize apart from like demonstrations and things like that?
I'm not so sure if you should go into it, because, Birgit, it's also a question to you. I would like to keep this interview really as a scholar interview. Okay. Because it's so difficult to keep the limits, the borders between being a political activist and a scholar. I mean, it's quite hard. Maybe you can talk about that, but I think we should keep our role as scholars.
Yeah, and I would say that what needs to be done is now research on these movements.
Yeah.
Of course, they started, as you said, the grandmothers against right. This is also a growing movement in the German-speaking countries, Omas gegen rechts. And they organize great activities, but they need to be researched and they need to be asked, what do you do with your sons and with your grandsons and granddaughters? So I think this would be an interesting case to do research. What is done against the far right and the further radicalization? But I think we are just at the beginning, but I'm quite sure that colleagues will do that. And but we shouldn't talk about that. I would agree with Paula because we didn't research on that. So it's just a program that needs to be
Done,
a research program. Mm-hmm.
If people would like to inform themselves more, do you have any tips for articles, scholarly articles, but also in mainstream media or podcasts or videos, anything you can think of?
So the research group decided to prepare two scholarly special issues of scientific journals. So they are in the making, they are in peer review. And they are both special issues are on normalization. One is on the how emotions and affects contribute to the normalization of the far right. We hope that we will get the reviews by the end of February so that it can be published within this year, 2025. Another special issue is more comparative. So we have examples of different countries, and they all focus on the contextual differences, but also similarities of processes on normalization. So we have already some peer reviews. So hopefully some of the articles will be published mid-2025. Huh?
And we also have interviews for all kinds of media and some articles published in the media that you can check with the homepage of the CIF.
Thank you very much for talking about this really important topic. I mean, we already talked about that. We could do like 20 episodes on that, of course. So obviously we only brushed the surface. Is there anything you'd like to add as kind of an end statement? Anything you that did not get said? No,
I don't think so.
No. I think it's thought a lot.
That's it.
Thank you very much. And we keep observing the situation, and I think there will be follow-ups to this discussion and this dialogue. Thank you very much for being here and for talking to me in our podcast. And as I already said, all the links and information on our guests will be in the show notes. And thank you very much for listening, and hear you next time. Bye.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. You.